A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the Mossad seizure of Iran's nuclear archive back in 2018, and he's zeroing in on something that gets overlooked in a lot of the coverage. The Iranians were storing their program documentation on optical media, CDs and DVDs, in what looked like a nondescript warehouse in Tehran. It was a literal air-gapped offline knowledge bank. And he's asking, what have we actually learned about how that material was stored, how Israel managed to extract it, and whether this was purely an archive or something more? Then he broadens the question, do terrorist organizations and rogue states have a track record of running illicit data centers to preserve not just weapons, but institutional know-how? There's a lot to pull apart here.
The optical media detail is the part that makes people do a double take, because it sounds almost comically retro. But it was deliberate. The Iranians understood something that a lot of sophisticated organizations forget. If you want something to stay offline, actually keep it offline. No network interface, no electromagnetic emissions, no remote exploitation surface. Just plastic disks in a safe in a building that looks like it stores carpets.
The lo-fi hip-hop of nuclear secrecy.
And the details that have emerged since the operation are genuinely remarkable. So let me lay out what we know. In January 2018, Mossad operatives broke into a facility in the Shorabad district of southern Tehran. This wasn't a military compound with guard towers and razor wire. It was a former industrial building, deliberately unremarkable, not even guarded in a way that would draw attention. The Iranians had rented it under a front company and used it to store the archive of the AMAD program, which was Iran's structured nuclear weapons development effort before it was formally suspended in 2003.
The formally suspended part is doing a lot of work there.
It always does. The archive contained about 55,000 pages of documents and 183 CDs containing additional technical data. Schematics, test plans, simulation results, manufacturing specifications for warhead components. The optical disks weren't just for show. They held CAD files, neutron transport calculations, explosive lens designs. This was the engineering backbone of a nuclear weapons program, and it was sitting in what amounted to a self-storage unit with better locks.
The question of whether this was purely an archive or something more, I think the answer is both. It was an offline knowledge bank, but it was also an active reference library for the scientists who were being kept on retainer.
That's the critical distinction. The AMAD program was officially halted, but the personnel weren't dispersed. They were reorganized under different organizational charts. SPND, which is the Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, and various university-affiliated centers. Those scientists needed access to the original work products. You can't rebuild a neutron initiator from memory. You need the test data, the material specifications, the tolerances. The archive was the institutional memory of the program, preserved so that reconstitution could happen on a compressed timeline.
The nuclear equivalent of keeping the old code base on a hard drive in a drawer, because you might need to spin up the service again.
That's exactly the right analogy. And the Iranians made a deliberate trade-off. By keeping the archive air-gapped on optical media, they sacrificed convenient access for security. If you want to pull up a specific document, someone has to physically retrieve the disk, put it in a machine that has never touched a network, and copy the file. It's slow. It's cumbersome. But it's immune to Stuxnet, to remote exfiltration, to any of the cyber capabilities that the US and Israel had already demonstrated against Iranian nuclear infrastructure.
Which is what makes the Mossad operation so extraordinary. They didn't hack their way in. They had to physically breach the facility, crack the safes, and exfiltrate half a ton of material. How did they pull that off?
The operational details are still classified, and honestly, the full picture probably won't be known for decades. But what has been reported and confirmed by Israeli officials in broad strokes is that Mossad had identified the warehouse sometime in 2016. They surveilled it for over a year. They mapped the security patterns, the comings and goings, the shift changes. And they discovered something critical. The Iranians had deliberately kept the external security footprint minimal to avoid drawing attention. The building didn't have a heavy uniformed guard presence. It relied on concealment, not fortification.
The security through obscurity approach applied to physical security, not just digital.
And it's a rational strategy in a dense urban environment. A fortified compound in southern Tehran raises questions. A dusty warehouse with a few guys who look like night watchmen doesn't. The trade-off is that once an adversary identifies the site, the physical security is not designed to repel a determined paramilitary assault.
Mossad had a window.
They had a window, and they took it on a single night in January 2018. According to the accounts that have been made public, including a detailed reconstruction by Ronan Birdman and others, the operatives entered the building, neutralized the guards non-lethally, and spent approximately 6.5 hours inside. They used cutting torches to open 32 safes. They removed the documents and the optical discs, loaded them into containers, and transported them out of the country.
6.5 hours inside hostile territory, cutting open 32 safes, and nobody noticed.
The Iranians had designed the facility to be invisible, and it was, including to their own security apparatus when it mattered. The Revolutionary Guard didn't learn about the breach until Mossad had already gotten the material across the border. And when they did discover it, they reportedly sealed off the neighborhood and conducted house-to-house searches for weeks, trying to figure out what had happened.
There's a deep irony in that. The very thing that made the archive secure against cyber intrusion, its physical isolation, made it vulnerable to a physical raid. And the low profile that kept it off satellite imagery meant there was no rapid response force nearby when someone did come knocking.
That's the fundamental tension in air gap security. You're trading one threat model for another. And the Iranians bet that physical compromise was the less likely scenario. They were wrong, but it wasn't an irrational bet. Most intelligence agencies would rather exfiltrate data remotely than mount a commando raid in a capital city. Mossad just happened to have both the intelligence and the operational capability to do the harder thing.
Let's talk about what was actually on those discs, because I think this gets to the second part of the question, whether this was just an archive or something closer to an operational knowledge management system.
The material that's been described publicly falls into several categories. First, there were the original AMAID project documents, formal reports, design specifications, test plans. Second, there were personnel records identifying the scientists and engineers who worked on specific components. Third, and this is the part that doesn't get enough attention, there was evidence of continued work after 2003. The archive wasn't frozen in amber. It had been updated, annotated, and in some cases expanded.
It wasn't just a time capsule.
It was a living repository. The Iranians had preserved not just the outputs, but the methodologies. If you have the original test data from a high-explosive lens experiment, you can validate new simulation models against it. If you have the manufacturing specifications for a neutron reflector, you can re-establish the supply chain. This was the know-how, not just the knowledge.
Which brings us to Daniel's point about terrorist organizations and rogue states operating what are essentially illicit data centers. I think there's a temptation to imagine that groups like Hezbollah or the Houthis are just running weapons caches, rockets in tunnels, explosives in safe houses. But the Iranian archive is a window into something more systematic.
It's not unique to Iran. Let me walk through what we know about this landscape. The most sophisticated non-state actors have been preserving technical knowledge in structured archives for decades. The IRA, during the Troubles, maintained detailed engineering documentation on their mortar designs and detonator circuits. Aum Shinrikyo in Japan kept laboratory notebooks from their chemical and biological weapons programs. Their sarin production records were recovered after the Tokyo subway attack, and they were meticulous.
Meticulous is the word that jumps out. We tend to think of these groups as chaotic, but the ones that survive long enough to pose a strategic threat are the ones that institutionalize.
Al-Qaeda in the pre-9/11 period maintained what amounted to a training library in their Afghan camps. Manuals on explosives chemistry, forged document production, operational security protocols. Some of this was distributed on paper, some on CD-ROMs, some on hard drives that were physically carried across borders. When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001, they recovered thousands of these items from safe houses and training facilities. ISIS took this to an industrial scale. Between 2014 and 2017, they operated a structured media and documentation apparatus across their territory in Iraq and Syria. They had dedicated servers for their propaganda output, but they also maintained offline archives of technical knowledge. Weapons manufacturing guides, drone modification manuals, chemical precursor acquisition strategies. Some of this was seized when their physical territory collapsed. A lot of it was dispersed beforehand.
The distributed node model that Daniel was getting at. You don't put everything in one warehouse if you've learned from watching others lose their warehouses.
And here's where the Iran case is instructive for understanding the broader pattern. The Tehran archive was a single point of failure design. One facility, one set of safes, one night's work to compromise it. The more sophisticated actors have moved toward distributed redundancy. Hezbollah, for instance, has been documented maintaining multiple parallel documentation centers across southern Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley. Not all of them hold the full archive. Some are specialized. Rocket manufacturing in one location, drone guidance systems in another, operational planning records in a third.
It's the nuclear knowledge equivalent of a raid array, striped across multiple locations, so losing any single node doesn't destroy the whole.
That's exactly the model, and it's enabled by the same technology the Iranians used. Optical media and portable hard drives are cheap, they're easy to replicate, and they can be physically transported without leaving a network trail. You burn 10 copies of the critical engineering data, distribute them to 10 locations, and now you've got resilience against both kinetic strikes and raids.
The irony being that the most sophisticated knowledge preservation systems in the non-state actor world are basically the backup strategy your IT department recommends for small businesses. Offline, off-site, multiple copies.
The question of whether these groups are running data centers in the conventional sense, racks of servers, network infrastructure, climate control, the answer is mostly no, but with some notable exceptions. What they're running is closer to what intelligence agencies call a dark archive. Physical media, secured locations, access restricted to a small number of trusted personnel, no network connectivity whatsoever.
The Iranian model, essentially.
The Iranian model, but in some cases with better operational security around the physical access patterns. The Iranians made the mistake of creating a routine. The guards changed shifts at predictable times. The same people came and went on the same schedules. Mossad's surveillance identified those patterns and exploited them. The more sophisticated groups vary their access patterns and use multiple redundant sites specifically, so that no single site's compromise is catastrophic.
What did Israel actually learn from the archive that changed the strategic picture? Because the raid was a tactical success, but the intelligence value is what justified the risk.
First, the archive provided proof, not just intelligence assessments, but documentary proof, that Iran had pursued nuclear weaponization in a structured, comprehensive way. This wasn't a smattering of research projects. The AMAD program had worked through the full engineering lifecycle. Warhead design, integration with the Shahab-3 missile, high explosive testing, neutron initiation. The documents included schematics for a device that could fit inside a missile nose cone.
Which directly contradicted Iran's narrative that their nuclear program had always been purely civilian.
And that had diplomatic consequences. When Netanyahu presented selected findings from the archive in April 2018, the IAEA was already investigating Iran's past activities, but the archive provided specific leads, names, dates, locations, technical specifications that shaped the agency's subsequent inquiries. The Trump administration cited the archive material when it withdrew from the JCPOA the following month.
Beyond the diplomatic impact, there was the operational intelligence, the personnel records.
That's the part that intelligence agencies care about most. The archive contained a list of the key scientists and engineers, their names, their specializations, their roles in the program. That's a targeting list, whether for sanctions, for recruitment as assets, or for more direct action. Several of the individuals named in the archive have since been targeted in operations that are widely attributed to Israel.
The archive wasn't just a snapshot of a program. It was a map of the people who could reconstitute it.
That's why the Iranians kept it. The knowledge doesn't disappear when the program is suspended. It resides in the people, and it resides in the documentation that lets new people get up to speed. If you lose your senior metallurgist, you need his notes on uranium casting. If your explosives expert defects, you need his lens design specifications. The archive was the continuity mechanism.
If we step back to the broader question, is this kind of knowledge archive unique to state programs, or do we see it across the spectrum of illicit actors? I think the answer is that the sophistication varies, but the pattern is consistent. Anyone who's serious about maintaining a technical capability over time needs an institutional memory.
The form that memory takes depends on the threat model. For groups that are primarily worried about infiltration by human intelligence, informants, defectors, the risk is that knowledge walks out the door in someone's head. The countermeasure is documentation that's access controlled. For groups worried about signals intelligence, the countermeasure is air gapping. For groups worried about physical raids, the countermeasure is distribution and redundancy.
Most groups get one or two of those right and fail on the third. The Iranians got air gapping right, got access control mostly right, and failed catastrophically on physical distribution.
Because they optimized for the threat they understood best. Iran's experience with Stuxnet in 2010 was formative. They learned correctly that network systems were vulnerable to sophisticated cyber attacks. They overlearned that lesson and underweighted the risk of a direct action raid. It's a classic intelligence failure pattern. You prepare to fight the last war.
The Stuxnet trauma has the ghost that haunted the archive's design.
Stuxnet demonstrated that even air-gapped industrial control systems could be compromised if someone got a USB drive across the gap. The Iranian response was to go even more offline. Optical media that could only be read by dedicated machines that had never been networked, stored in a facility that wasn't connected to any external network, in a building that wasn't obviously a secure facility. They solved the cyber problem completely, and in doing so, they created a physical problem that Mossad solved in one night.
There's something almost philosophical here about the nature of security. Every defense creates a corresponding vulnerability. The question is whether you understand what you're now vulnerable to.
Whether your adversary is capable of exploiting that vulnerability. In this case, the Iranians bet that Israel either wouldn't find the facility or wouldn't be willing to mount a commando operation in downtown Tehran. They were wrong on both counts.
Let's talk about the optical media choice specifically, because Daniel mentioned it and it's interesting from a technical perspective. CDs and DVDs in 2018, this wasn't just air gapping, this was deliberately choosing a medium that's physically readable without specialized equipment, but not remotely accessible.
It's actually a smart choice for this use case. Optical discs are stable over decades if stored properly. They're immune to electromagnetic pulse. They can't be remotely erased or corrupted. They leave no metadata trail when accessed. No log files, no access timestamps that could be recovered forensically if the reading machine is properly sanitized. And they're cheap enough that you can make multiple copies without it being a budgetary line item.
The downside being that 183 CDs fit in a duffel bag.
Which is exactly what happened. The very portability that makes optical media convenient for distributed storage also makes it convenient for exfiltration. Mossad didn't need to image hard drives or bypass encryption. They just needed to pick up the discs and walk out.
It's almost perversely considerate of the Iranians to have packaged their entire nuclear archive in a grab-and-go format.
There's a reason intelligence agencies call a successful exfiltration a clean sweep. This was about as clean as it gets. The operatives didn't need to spend time triaging what to take. They took everything.
What's the current state of knowledge about where the archive material ended up, and what's been done with it?
The physical material was transported to Israel and has been analyzed extensively by Israeli intelligence, with key findings shared with the IAEA and with allied intelligence services. The documents have informed sanctions designations, provided leads for further intelligence collection, and shaped the diplomatic understanding of where Iran's program actually stood. Some of the material has been selectively declassified and presented publicly. Netanyahu's 2018 presentation was the most prominent example, but there have been subsequent disclosures as well.
What did they learn from this?
That's the question that keeps intelligence analysts up at night. The Iranians almost certainly restructured their knowledge management after the raid. The logical move would be to shift from a centralized archive to a distributed model with encrypted digital storage at multiple sites, potentially with some kind of dead man switch or continuity of access protocol. But we don't know the specifics, and that's by design. They're not going to make the same mistake twice.
The distributed node model we were talking about earlier. If you're Iran in 2018, and you've just lost your entire nuclear documentation in one night, you're not rebuilding a single warehouse. You're building a network.
You're probably moving away from optical media for some of it, ironically. Encrypted solid-state storage with proper key management gives you better access control. If a drive is seized, properly implemented encryption means the data is inaccessible. A CD has no such protection. If you have the disk, you have the data.
The archive raid may have actually pushed Iranian knowledge management toward better security practices, not worse ones.
That's the unintended consequence of any successful operation. You win the battle, and in doing so, you teach the adversary how to fight the next one. The Iranians of 2026 are not the Iranians of 2018. They've had 8 years to redesign their approach.
Which brings me to something Daniel's prompt touches on that I think is worth exploring. He mentioned the idea that the uranium model, meaning the physical nuclear material, might be less a concentrated stockpile and more a distributed network of nodes, similar to the knowledge archive approach. Is there evidence for that?
It's a logical inference rather than something we have direct evidence for, but the logic is sound. If you're running a clandestine nuclear program, you don't want all your centrifuges in one building, all your uranium hexafluoride in one storage depot, all your casting work in one facility. You distribute so that no single strike can cripple your entire capability. We've seen this in the way Iran has hardened and dispersed its enrichment facilities. Fordow is buried under a mountain, Natanz has been rebuilt after sabotage, and there are smaller sites that don't appear on the public IAEA reporting.
The knowledge to operate all of that, the procedures, the specifications, the troubleshooting guides, that knowledge has to live somewhere accessible to the operators at each node.
Which means you need either a secure network connecting the nodes, and we know Iran has invested heavily in its secure communications infrastructure, or you need local copies of the critical knowledge at each site. Given the Stuxnet trauma, I'd bet on local copies. The risk of a network being compromised is just too high.
The archive that Mossad seized may have been the master copy, but there were almost certainly working copies distributed to the operational sites.
The question is how complete those working copies were. The master archive had the full engineering history, the dead ends, the failed tests, the design iterations. A working copy at an enrichment facility probably has the specific procedures and specifications relevant to that facility. It's the difference between the full Git repository and the deployment branch.
If you lose the full repository, you can still operate from the deployment branch, but you've lost the ability to understand why certain design decisions were made, or to adapt to new constraints.
You can follow the recipe, but you can't modify it. That's a significant degradation of capability over the long term, but it doesn't prevent near-term operations.
Let's broaden this out to the non-state actor question, because I think that's where the most interesting implications are. Are we seeing terrorist organizations adopt the kind of systematic knowledge management that we've been describing for Iran?
Yes, with important caveats. The most sophisticated groups understand that institutional knowledge is a strategic asset. Hezbollah's technical documentation on rocket manufacturing, which has been recovered from sites in Syria and Lebanon, shows a systematic approach to capturing engineering knowledge, material specifications, quality control procedures, failure analysis. This isn't a guy with a notebook. This is a structured technical documentation effort.
The storage methods.
Some of it is on paper, some on local servers, some on portable media. The key insight is that these groups face different constraints than a state actor. They don't have a fixed territory they can defend. They have to be mobile, which means their archives have to be portable or distributed. A server farm in a cave is a target. 100 USB drives distributed across 100 safe houses is resilient.
The dark archive is a guerrilla tactic.
And it's not just about weapons. Groups like the Taliban have maintained extensive records of tribal affiliations, land ownership, and local power structures, the kind of information you need to govern effectively when you take territory. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula kept detailed personnel files on recruits, including skills assessments and psychological profiles. This is organizational knowledge management, not just bomb-making manuals.
When Daniel asks whether these groups are running illicit data centers, the answer is that they're running something more interesting. They're running distributed knowledge networks optimized for resilience under persistent pressure.
They're doing it with remarkably mundane technology. This isn't a Hollywood scenario with blinking servers in an underground bunker. It's laptops in apartments, CDs in false walls, paper documents in waterproof containers buried in the desert. The low-tech approach is a feature, not a bug.
The ultimate air gap is a hole in the ground.
During the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, the Taliban captured a significant amount of material that had been left behind by the former government and by international forces. But their own institutional archives, the records they had maintained through 20 years of insurgency, were largely intact and inaccessible to their adversaries throughout that entire period. That's a successful knowledge preservation strategy.
There's something almost admirable about the discipline required to maintain that kind of institutional memory under those conditions. I don't mean admirable in a moral sense. Obviously, these are groups engaged in horrific violence. But from a purely organizational perspective, the ability to preserve technical knowledge across decades of being hunted is non-trivial.
It's one of the reasons certain groups have staying power while others collapse after losing a few key personnel. If your bomb maker is killed and his knowledge dies with him, you're back to square one. If his bomb-making knowledge is documented and distributed, you promote his apprentice and keep going. The groups that invest in knowledge management are the ones that survive leadership decapitation.
Which is, when you think about it, exactly why the Mossad raid on the Iranian archive was so damaging. They didn't just take documents. They took the institutional memory that would have allowed the program to survive the loss of key personnel.
They took it in a way that the Iranians couldn't immediately assess the damage. When the archive was discovered missing, the Iranians knew what was taken physically, but they didn't know what Israel now knew. Which specific vulnerabilities had been exposed, which personnel had been identified, which facilities had been documented. That uncertainty is itself a form of damage.
The fog of breached archives.
And it takes years to work through the implications. Every scientist named in the documents has to assume they're compromised. Every facility described has to be assessed for whether its cover is blown. It's not just the loss of the information, it's the loss of confidence in everything that information touched.
Let me ask you something that I haven't seen addressed much in the public coverage. The archive contained optical media, CDs, and DVDs. Was there any indication that these were manufactured in a way that could be traced? Because optical disc manufacturing leaves forensic signatures. The specific stamper used, the dye formulation, even the factory where the polycarbonate was molded.
That's a fascinating question, and I don't know the answer. If the Iranians were sophisticated about it, they would have sourced blank media from multiple commercial suppliers in a way that didn't create a traceable pattern. If they weren't, the discs themselves could have provided intelligence about supply chains and procurement networks.
It's the kind of detail that intelligence analysts would absolutely exploit. If you can identify that a particular batch of CDs was manufactured in a specific factory in Malaysia and sold through a specific distributor in Dubai, you now have a lead on the procurement network for the nuclear program.
That's the kind of secondary intelligence value that the archive almost certainly provided. It wasn't just about what was on the discs. The physical objects themselves, the safes, the discs, the paper, the ink, the organizational system, all of that tells you something about how the program operated.
The medium is the metadata.
And speaking of metadata, one of the things that made the archive so valuable was that the Iranians had kept original documents with handwritten annotations. Scientists had marked up schematics, added comments to test reports, corrected calculations in the margins. That kind of marginalia is intelligence gold. It shows you who was thinking about what they were worried about, what they were trying to optimize.
The human element that you lose in a purely digital archive.
A PDF of a report tells you what the report says. A physical copy with a nuclear physicist's notes in the margins tells you what he was thinking when he read it. That's a different order of intelligence.
Where does this leave us in terms of the broader landscape? We've got state actors like Iran preserving nuclear know-how in offline archives. We've got non-state actors preserving weapons knowledge in distributed networks. Is there a common thread here about the relationship between secrecy and institutional memory?
The common thread is that secrecy and accessibility are in constant tension, and every organization makes trade-offs between them. The more accessible your knowledge is to your own people, the more vulnerable it is to compromise. The more secure you make it, the harder it is for your own people to use it effectively. The Iranians optimized for security at the expense of accessibility, and they got burned when the security failed. Other groups optimize for accessibility and get burned when someone flips an insider.
There's no perfect solution.
There's no perfect solution. The best you can do is understand your threat model, distribute your risk, and accept that no system is invulnerable. The Iranians thought they had done that. They were wrong, but not because they were stupid. They were wrong because their adversary was more capable than they anticipated.
Which is the oldest story in intelligence work?
It really is. Every intelligence failure in history can be summarized as, "We didn't think they could do that." The Mossad operation is a case study in why you should never underestimate what a determined adversary can pull off.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1990s, German historian Herbert Illig proposed the phantom time hypothesis, claiming that nearly 3 centuries of the early Middle Ages were fabricated and never happened. For years, a popular internet claim circulated that Illig specifically argued the entire 7th century was invented by the Holy Roman Emperor Otto III as a propaganda exercise. This was not Illig's actual argument. He claimed the fabrication covered the years 614 to 911, and he never attributed it to Otto III. The misattribution appears to have originated from an early 2000s Usenet post that conflated Illig's thesis with a separate fringe theory about calendar reform.
I appreciate that even the phantom time hypothesis has its own phantom citations.
The conspiracy theory about the conspiracy theory. That's almost elegant.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. We'll be back with another one.
Until then, keep your archives distributed and your safes unpredictable.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.